Hi, it's Diane. On my mind, Stephen Sondheim, the legendary composer and lyricist, died in November at age 91, known for his works Company, A Little Night Music, and Sweeney Todd. Sondheim's career culminated with his 1984 masterpiece, Sunday in the Park with George. It told the story of the agonized life of painter Georges Seurat. Mandy Patinkin played the title role in that production and helped workshop the musical from its early days. So when I heard news of Sondheim's death, I immediately thought of an interview I recorded with Patinkin back in 2002. He had just performed a tribute concert for Stephen Sondheim. Patinkin talked about what made Sondheim's work so powerful and his own path in musical theater. I'm happy to share that interview from my archives this holiday season.
For joining us, I'm Diane Rehm. This summer, the Kennedy Center here in Washington is paying tribute to American composer Stephen Sondheim. One of Sondheim's biggest fans is actor and singer Mandy Patinkin. He's currently performing a concert of his favorite Sondheim songs. He joins us this hour to talk about this and other aspects of his varied career. Well, it's a pleasure to see you again.
Well, it's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
I was in the audience last night when you were here at the Kennedy Center to participate in this Sondheim celebration.
Right.
Why does Sondheim grab you so?
Oh, God, we're so lucky to have him. He's just the Shakespeare of our time in terms of lyrics, in terms of simplicity, in terms of wisdom, in terms of an unconscious, I think, insightfulness toward human condition. And I think he embodies, as so many great artists do, a natural struggle in terms of life, that he is able to write down his wishes for himself and for the world in not only this amazing poetry, but this gorgeous music. And if I was able to write, I would write every word that he wrote, because he writes so much of what I wish for.
So were you invited to do this performance because people know that you love his work so, or did you just step forward and say, I'll do this?
Another way it came about is I was working on another project, and my record producer, Robert Hurwitz from Nonesuch Records, said to me at one point, I don't know, about a year and a half ago, I'd love you to work on a Sondheim piece, because he said the first place I saw you was in Sunday in the Park with George, and he felt that that's what he wanted me to do. So I called Paul Ford, my piano player, and I discussed this with him, and then we called Steve Sondheim, and I asked if we could get into his files. Steve has a file system in his house, and there's a number of drawers, and each drawer holds every single piece of paper with every single lyric that he's ever written for each particular piece, on envelopes, on backs of scrap paper, on newspaper sidings, anything. And then the manuscripts are written in pencil, which do have erasers, but there's virtually nothing that's been discarded. So we collected 10 hours of material. We went through everything, and he gave us access to everything.
Of course, one of your best-known roles was Sunday in the Park with George.
Right.
Mademoiselles, you and me, pal, second bottle, she looks for me, bonnet flapping, yapping, roar! Chicken, pastry. Yes, she looks for me. Good. Let her look for me to tell me why she left me, as I always knew she would. I had thought she understood. They have never understood, and no reason that they should. But if anybody could, finishing the
house. You are in such deep concentration as you're listening to this.
I was thinking while I was listening that it was recorded in 1984. My oldest son was 2 years old, Isaac, and I remember some of the thoughts that were in my mind back then. And what is so terrifying and enlightening and hopeful at the same time is how poignant those same words are to me. I can't even do the math so many years later. It's just extraordinary how somebody writes something like that and it speaks to you over time.
From the height, coming from the hat, studying the hat, entering the world of the hat, reaching through the world of the hat like a window, back to this one from that, studying a face, stepping back to look at a face, leaves a little space in the way, like a window.
That was called finishing the hat.
Right.
What's going on in that scene?
Well, he also says starting on the hat. What's going on is everything in the world for this man. As an artist in the play, he is trying to create this painting that in real life he actually finished and then painted over the entire painting. At 30 years old, he had never had his painting shown in any major exhibition.
We should say this is Georges Seurat.
Yes, this is Georges Seurat, and his mother supported him, and the only time that painting was shown Sunday afternoon on the island of the Grand Jatte was over essentially what was like a Coca-Cola stand of the time. And but now that painting is everything in my life that I begin, my life with my children, my hopes for them, my life with my wife that's ever-changing as our children are leaving the house, and it's essentially a new life that we begin and are preparing to begin. So half with one out, half with the other, you know, who already has one foot out the door.
Mm.
And then I keep working on projects that are in the business. So it's both it both is finishing the hat of a piece of work that's in business, but finishing the hat of each stage of our life for me.
I read that, in fact, when you were preparing for this role, or when you were in the midst of it, you went to the gallery.
Yes.
To stand in front of this painting.
Twice.
And that you had problems because some people around you did not fully appreciate the painting. And you actually got into some conversations with them.
Yes. I remember I went to the Art Institute in Chicago.
Which I adore.
Yes.
It's a great
place. Terrific. And I went there a lot as a kid. And so I went there twice, once before the workshop and once before we moved it, when we started work again, before we took it to Broadway. And I stood there. The second act begins very much in the realm of people looking at a painting in a gallery. So it was the actual scene of the second act where people are commenting, I don't see anything, it looks silly to me, it's all of that. And actually, they're doing it about a chromoloom, which is something that his great-grandson made years later. But it was criticizing an artist's work. So I listened to that for a while, and then I began to ignore it. And I started looking at the painting. And then I began singing the whole show very quietly to myself, looking at the painting, relating to each character in the painting, going up extremely close so that the guards came up to ask me to stand back several times, because I would ignore them each time, because I wanted to see the red, 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 green, red, red, green, blue, yellow, green.
Mm.
I wanted to see those colors close so that when you pulled back. And then as I left, I knew that he had never reached any recognition in his lifetime. And I knew that for whatever reason, it had certainly hung in the museum for a long time, but we were going to now display it in another venue. And hopefully it would get some more attention, and that I was going to be part of this conduit to this man, to people's awareness of his legacy. And I wanted to do right by him, and I asked him, by looking at his painting, to help me.
To help you?
Just help me in any way he could, if he's listening.
And of course he died at 31.
Yes.
Extraordinary.
Having just the visions, no solution. Everything depends on execution. Putting it together, that's what counts.
The board of the foundation is meeting next week.
Ounce by ounce, putting it together.
You'll come to lunch.
Small amounts, adding up to make a work of art. First of all, you need a good foundation. Otherwise, it's risky from the start. Takes a little cocktail conversation, but without the proper preparation. Having just the visions, no solution. Everything depends on execution. The art of making art is putting it together, bit by bit.
Oh, we haven't met. Charles Redmond, County Museum of Texas. Wanted you to know we're in the process of giving out some sizable commissions.
Link by link,
well, I hope you don't mind
connections.
My bringing up business during a social occasion.
Drink by drink, fixing and perfecting the design. Adding just a dab of politician, always knowing where to draw the line. Lining up the funds, but in addition, lining up a prominent commission. Otherwise your perfect composition isn't going to get much exhibition. Art isn't easy. Every minor detail is a major decision. Have to keep things in scale. Have to hope to...
Even the enunciation of each of these words is extraordinary, man.
Well, we have Harold Prince to thank for that. When I was doing Evita, Hal came backstage one day and he said to me, "I want to hear those consonants. If I cannot understand the words, do not come to the theater." And I never forgot it, and I devoted my life to taking that note to heart.
Art isn't easy, any way you look at it.
George, hello. Lee Randall. I handle the public relations for the museum.
Doctor by doctor, building up the image. Shot by shot, keeping it a distance doesn't pay. Still, if you remember your objective, not give all your privacy away. A little bit of hype can be effective, long as you can keep it in perspective. After all, without some recognition, no one's going to give you a commission. Art isn't easy.
I remember the most extraordinary conversation I had with anybody while we were doing the piece was a scientist came backstage afterwards, and he said to me, "God, this place spoke to me." And I said, "Really? What do you do?" And he said, "I'm an economist." And I said, "Oh." And he said, my greatest fear in life was that I would not ever have a discovery, and that if I did, I wouldn't have one later. And I realized at that moment, because that was George's greatest fear, Seurat's, that he would only have one painting, if one painting, would he ever be able to paint another one later? And I just thought it was an amazing metaphor that spoke to everyone in terms of the art that all of us are involved in, whether it be the art of creating a relationship, a family, a work, saving a country, finding peace in the Middle East. Whatever we do is a kind of art form, and how we all hold that terror. Will we have the inspiration? Will we be able to see it to fruition? And then will we have another one, because it is a moving thing?
You know, last night's performance was so different from that I saw several years ago, in which you both sang and talked.
Yes.
Last night, it was an hour and 20 minutes of solid singing.
Right.
How do you do it, Mandy?
Well, first of all, there's nothing that I'm going to say that's going to equal Mr. Sondheim's words, A. But B, I wanted this to be a much more classically oriented concert, similar to my Mamelushin concert, which is in Yiddish. Those are the two pieces that I've created so far that are classical in orientation. There is no talking. There is no dialogue from me. There's no patter. There's no anything of recognition what's going on with the audience. It is done as a classical piece. I stand there and I present the material with Paul Ford playing it on the piano. And in this case, we even use a grand piano, which is the only show we have ever done with a grand piano. We do all the others with an upright Yamaha.
Really?
Yes, but because I wanted a classical feeling.
Mandy Patinkin, I think listeners are going to be more than a little surprised to hear you say that at one point you thought you were losing your voice.
Yes. It was a couple of years, about 2-3 years ago. Actually, it was a few more years ago. I was like in my mid-40s, just starting in my mid-40s. I'm in my late-40s. I'm ending my 40s this year. But I didn't know what was happening. All of a sudden, I'd walk on stage 30 minutes into a performance. It would start to lock. I'd lose it. Also, my
neck. What do you mean, lock?
It would just lock. It would get very tight. I felt that everything, I couldn't support it anymore. I was strong, and yet whatever I was using from my gut or my legs to bring up the strength, I had to use like 10 times the amount. I thought by 30 minutes into an hour and a half performance, I was shot. I didn't know where it was coming from. I would sit there and pray that I'd just make it through. I'd be exhausted. My voice would be tired, and I was just like playing catch-up ball the whole time.
And depressed, I'm sure.
Oh, very. Not only depressed, I thought, my God, this is what 40 is. I guess
it's
your life's over at 40.
It's over.
And I didn't know what to do. My neck would get tight. My shoulder would get tight. Everything. I went to acupuncturists, every kind of physical therapist, chiropractors, voice doctors. I didn't know what to do. I'd been seeing a person for several years that I hadn't gone to for a while, but who did a very good job, and I'd do his exercises, but I'd had it, and I was ready to give up, and I started thinking, well, I'll go do something else now. I've lost this, and trying to adjust to that. My wife had kept saying she wanted me to see a woman named Joan Lader in New York City, and then my piano player kept saying that, too, and several people, not only singers, but many people who just speak for a living, went to see Joan. And finally, I just broke down and I said, all right, I'll go see this person. But it's not like I don't know what I'm doing. I know what I'm doing. No one's going to help me. And I walked in there and she had me sing for a little. She says, what in the world are you doing? I said, what do you mean? She says, stand up. Put your chin up. You got your chin up. Put your chin up. What are you doing? And she stopped everything I was doing. She took away, essentially pulled the rug out from under me and started to teach me how to walk again. She sent me to yoga classes. She, within 3 weeks, I started doing certain yoga exercises. It completely loosened up my neck. She told me, I was told to keep my head down to shorten the space for my voice. She said, get your chin up, put your head up. She said a variety of other things. I work constantly if I vocalize for a half hour or when I'm rehearsing for 2-3 hours. I keep a small, like those 2-pound weight balls,
yes,
you know, that you work on with,
yes,
the gym, or just a normal rubber ball, and I squeeze it between my knees. I stand on my toes. I walk backwards. She would have me swing my hands up in the air like a helicopter as I'm walking backwards. All of this to get the tension and get everything relaxed that was in my throat, that gradually I would start to sing as though I would be pitching a baseball or getting ready to hold a bat up high. My right shoulder would start to rise and my whole body, and that just became my style. And I thought, well, that's what I need to do to support it. Well, I tell you, I worked with her for 6 weeks, and then I went on a 15-week tour. I never had a single problem again since then.
Wow.
And I do it religiously. I do it before every performance. She taught me how to cool down my voice after a performance. I don't see anybody until I go in the dressing room, and I do a 5-minute cool down. I also do exercises after the performance. And then when we rehearse on every day, I do these strengthening things. And I just... I owe her so much because I was doing the wrong thing. And, you know, after you're a certain age and you've studied and you've been out there, you think, well, I know what I'm
doing.
I know
it all.
You know, I
sure
know it. I've learned. I'm tired of going to school. I've been with a bunch of experts. And and you never, you know, somebody needs to teach you anew.
Anybody ever talk to you about spasmodic dysphonia?
Only you.
All right, I'm going to see Joan later.
I guarantee you she'll help you.
All right, we've got lots of callers, Mandy, so let's open the phones to Concord, New Hampshire. Good morning, Kathy.
Good morning. Mr. Patinkin, it's an honor to talk to you.
Thank you.
I had the pleasure of seeing you a couple of years ago in Concord, New Hampshire, and you're coming back in April, and you're going to be doing your music from Sondheim then, and I'm looking forward to that also.
Great.
The first time I saw you was in the movie The Princess Bride.
Right.
And I'm wondering if you would do me the favor of saying your infamous line for me.
Okay.
I love this line.
Hello. My name is Inigo Montoya. You killed my father. Prepare to die.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
That's wonderful. Thanks for calling. Your latest album is one for kids. It's called Kid Adults.
Kid Adults.
Excuse me.
No problem.
How did you choose the songs that went into that?
Well, Paul Ford, my piano player, right-hand man, and left side of my brain, we just sat down over time and we put together a lot of songs that we thought would be appropriate for children. Then I wasn't happy just picking songs for children, and then I finally realized that the kid and the adult in me, because I got my one foot in the kid door till the day I die, and so we opened the gates up a little more, and we were looking then for songs that spoke to the child and the adult also. And so we put these songs in combination, both songs that were completely appropriate for children and also totally appropriate for children but spoke to the child and the adult also. So that's what we were after.
This one's called Not While I'm Around.
Right, by Steve Sondheim.
And tell me.
Not while I'm around, nothing's gonna harm you, no sir. Not while I'm around, demons are prowling everywhere nowadays. I'll send them howling, I don't care. I got ways. No one's gonna hurt you. No one's gonna dare.
This one's actually in Sweeney Todd.
Right.
Tell us about that.
Well, I sing it not as a song from Sweeney Todd, just as a song from this world and this life. Initially, it was to sing to the members of my family, to myself, to my friends. Then September 11th happened, and it had far greater reaching echoes. I wouldn't say greater, I would just say certainly still to my family and loved ones, but also to the whole world, in saying that we must believe that just what those words are saying, not to worry, not to worry. Nothing's going to harm you, not while I'm around. Whistle, I'll be there. And I think these songs just have phenomenal echoes when I hear them from day to day, and depending on what's going on in the world, that I wish every Palestinian and every Israeli could listen to these words and believe in them. And that what is, you know, when they say demons will harm you, that the demons can be solved by efforts of peace, and that we needn't be afraid, and we can work together. And I just think songs like this should be the anthems for the world.
It's a tough world right
Certainly
now,
is.
Andy.
No one's gonna dare. Others can desert you, not to worry. Whistle, I'll be there. Demons will charm you. A smile for a while, but in time,
you know, Mandy, there's yet another one from this album. You've got to be carefully taught, children will listen. Actually, this one appears on the Oscar and Steve album,
right,
from South Pacific. I want to hear a little of this and then get you to talk about how you've actually changed it.
Yeah! You've got to be taught to hate and fear. You've got to be taught from year to year. It's got to be drummed in your dear little ear. You've got to be carefully taught. You've got to be taught to be afraid of people whose eyes are oddly made and people whose skin is a different shade. You've got to be carefully taught. You've got to be taught before it's too late, before you are six for 7 or 8 to hate all the people your relatives hate!
Careful the things you say. Children will listen. Careful the things you do. Children will see and learn. Children may not obey, but children.
You actually changed part of this.
I sure did.
After September 11th.
We began our Cadults tour on September 10th last year at the Neil Simon Theater in New York. I decided, I didn't know quite how to put the whole concert together because it wasn't just songs from Cadults, it was a whole potpourri smorgasbord evening. But it centered on songs from Cadults. And finally, when I figured out how to end the concert, I worked backwards from there. And I decided to end the concert with a prayer for the prayer for peace for the Middle East. I put 3 songs together. First, I took out, I had Paul play like a little tinkle on the piano at the high end so it sounded like a child's music box, while he was playing the beginning of Hatikva, the Israeli national anthem, which I also wanted to, which I sang in Hebrew, like a children's lullaby. I unraveled an Israeli flag, the same size that little John Kennedy waved at his father's funeral, and then I unraveled a Palestinian flag. I put them in 2 little stands right next to each other on a stool. I sang the Israeli national anthem in Hebrew, wanted to sing a Palestinian anthem, but I didn't know it. And at the end of that, I had the lights bathe in red, go to blood red. I knocked the 2 flags over, created a sound that was like an explosion from the piano and distorted it from the speakers, and then sang, You've Got to Be Carefully Taught, as I did there like Hitler on the podium. A great irony about hatred and fear, hoping for peace and understanding. And then I finished it, lifted the flags up, the lights went back to normal, and sang this song, Children Will Listen. Then, 10 hours later, I went up to my roof and watched the world changing as I watched it unfold. I was called by NPR that was going to do a live, not NPR, Public Broadcasting, or maybe it was with NPR, I can't remember, from the Riverside Church in New York, doing a multi, all these different religions together and different artists, prayer and hope for peace for the world, a healing concert. And they said, could I do something? And I immediately called Paul Ford and I said, we have to rearrange everything. Mm. Now, instead of a prayer for peace for just the Middle East, it needed to be a prayer for peace for the whole world. So I cut the flags, I cut the Hatikva, I cut the loud explosion, I cut the blood red lights, because we didn't need any imagined images anymore. The real thing was far too prevalent in our minds. And so I changed the You've Got to Be Carefully Taught to a children's lullaby, whispered, hardly spoken, hardly sung. And that led right into Children Will Listen. And then I went right on the road, and I did 59 concerts in 38 cities across the country after September 10th. And it was the most extraordinary time in my life. And that's how we ended every concert, with that prayer for peace.
To St. Louis, Missouri. George, you're on the air.
Yes, ma'am. How are you doing?
Fine, thanks. And you?
I'm wonderful.
Good.
I just wanted to say what an honor it is to speak with this man. I recently graduated with a master's in vocal performance. I have a minor in theater performance, and he's been just a great mentor from afar, I guess, in my life for quite some time. I also wanted to ask you, I'm about to get married, and I'm certain that she and I will want to start a family. I know you're a family man yourself. What are the possibilities, and how difficult is it, or is it possible to have a family and lead the life you lead?
It's 100% possible. It'll take more work than anything you've ever done in your life. Never give up. If you love each other, that'll be your greatest problem and your greatest gift at the same time.
Now a quick break. When we come back, more of my 2002 conversation with singer and actor Mandy Patinkin.
And we're back. Here's the rest of my conversation with Mandy Patinkin from June 2002.
Mandy, you clearly have so many fans out there. Let's take a caller in Akron, Ohio. Good morning, Lisa.
Oh, good morning, and thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
You're a phenomenal artist and an inspiration, and I wanted to thank you especially lately for the Kidults album.
Well, thank you.
I have a four-year-old, and it is such a joy to have her wandering around the house singing Sondheim instead of some of your more popular kid stuff that we all get subjected to nonstop.
Right.
And I really appreciate that in the album, you know, as a parent, you do not underestimate children.
Oh, God, underestimate. They know more than anybody.
Oh,
you can't
they do.
Hide anything from them.
And it's not just that, as you were saying earlier, that children will listen. I think that we all need to listen more to them.
Yeah.
And I just wanted to let you know that Not While I'm Around has become her favorite lullaby.
Oh, how lovely.
She couldn't pick a better one.
Thanks for calling,
Thank
Lisa.
Thank you, Mandy.
Thank you. Thanks, Steve Sondheim.
You know, speaking of Sondheim, Joe in St. Louis has sent us an email saying, why do you think Sondheim's work has never achieved huge commercial success?
I don't have an answer that I understand. It's just some oddity of maybe this country in terms of not cherishing its heritage and what its true values are. And by that I mean, it's so odd that in London and England, Arthur Miller, maybe one of our greatest playwrights, and Stephen Sondheim are thought of as gods there. They're at the highest level, they're treated beyond royalty. And it's taken, thank God, for the Kennedy Center that is honoring Steve with this incredible festival of all of his work. But to take so long for this to happen isn't right, as far as I'm concerned. I'm glad that it's finally happened, and I hope that other people pick up the baton. I don't know why people don't. I think people are lazy in this country to some degree.
So they have to work too
they have
hard.
To work. They have to work a little hard. They have to use their minds in ways that maybe they just want to go to the theater and escape. He challenges you. It's very hard after you've sung Stephen Sondheim to sing other things, because the level of content and meaning and metaphor are so profound that if you enjoy that way of thinking, you know, the other is also, there's much other stuff that I sing by many other people that's wonderful and a great break and entertaining and being silly, and all of that's necessary. But you don't walk away from his show singing and dancing. You walk away full of wonder and full of hope, and realizing that the darkest moments that fill your life can be filled with light instead of darkness.
You know, Joe in St. Louis goes on to say, does the American public demand a happy ending?
I'm afraid they might, and I'm afraid that they're also learning now, given the state of the world, that happy endings are not what define America anymore. We are now part of a larger community called the world. The reality has struck, and as much as we want to ensure our safety, we are living the lives to some degree now that everyone in the world lives.
So let's take us back a little bit to something that surely everyone knows and appreciates.
Fall of the wave in the sky, the tides creeping off on the beach like a thief, afraid to be caught stealing the light. There's a hell of a lot of stars in the sky. The sky's so big, the sea looks small. And two little people, you and I, we don't count at all. If I loved you, time and again I would try to say, all I'd want you to know. if I loved you, words wouldn't come an easy way. Round in circles I go.
Hard to hear that song without getting totally lost.
Well, it's just such a hopeful tune. It's a tune that can bring back anyone that's left us. It's a tune that can make anyone who's having a hard time listening to themselves or the person they're with wake up, look, and listen. And it's filled with hope beyond hope. And that's what we live for right now. And this tour that I did this last year was the best tour of my life. To go on the road at that time in this country when people were afraid to go out, when all these warnings were happening, and to have a job where I got to go out and entertain, sing these extraordinary lyrics by extraordinary human beings who put out nothing but wishes and hopes, was the greatest privilege that I'd ever experienced, and I'd never realized what a privilege it was until this past year. To the degree that I realized it.
I want to ask you about the range of your voice from this wonderful low place that you have in you up to an almost falsetto. And you told the story on this program about singing in a choir.
Yeah.
And I want you to tell it again.
Sure. I was in high school, and I was on the south side of Chicago. I think I was the only white kid in an all-African-American chorus. And Lena McClin, the choral teacher, an extraordinary African-American woman, one day asked me to sing a solo. Well, we had soloists, you know, like Aretha Franklin types in our class that were just amazing. And I hated that Broadway sound of that big belting thing. You know, I didn't want to do that. So one particular part came, and I sang it in that high voice that I did. And I thought I was going to get yelled at and get an F in chorus. And, you know, she looked at me, and I said, I'm sorry. I know you wanted, like, a big opera sound. And she said, honey, she said, child, you listen to Lena right now. She said, you use that voice anytime you want. Anybody tells you that you shouldn't do it, you haven't come talk to Lena. So that, I just remembered that, and I just figured, okay, fine. And then knowing that I could do that by her giving me the permission, let me then go do the loud sounds, the operatic sounds, the deeper sounds, and play with my voice anyway that, see, I don't read music. I don't read a note of music.
You don't?
No, I wish I did because I want to play the piano, and maybe one day I will, but because I don't read it, I don't really know what my high or low is. You know, a lot of singers will come in and go, oh, I can't do anything past the this, or I can't go the whole low, so it's got to be in this key. Well, I don't have any letters, so I don't know what key I sing, so I'm sort of a musical idiot. I'll try anything.
But did kids make fun of you?
Oh, God, no. I mean, there are people that say, you know, oh, the guy with the girl's voice. And I have a girl's name, so why shouldn't I have a girl's voice?
All right, let's go to Knightstown, Indiana. Good morning, Judith.
Hello.
Hi.
First, I'd like to say that I grew up in Chicago, and I was one of the fortunate children whose parents took her to the Art Institute regularly, and I grew up looking at the George Seurat painting several times a year, and my sister and I loved that painting. And I can see it in my mind without any effort at all. So I can really appreciate what you say about looking at it. My question is, I also grew up loving the musical theater. I wanted to be Julie Andrews when I grew up. But I'm so discouraged by the fact that young people, I don't know what the age is, under 40, under 30, they're totally unfamiliar with things which are touchstones to me. I can say, oh, you know, this is like in My Fair Lady,
uh-huh.
And nobody knows.
We lost her.
Right, but I know where you're getting to, and how do we touch those stones, and what do we do, and what's happened? Look, it's been a tremendous frustration for me. There, I got to do one Stephen Sondheim show. I got to do a concert of another one of his shows. He's the greatest writer. He does not write for any particular actor. He writes for the idea, thank God. That's the way it should be. There are other writers that are out there today. They are working hard. There's a young man named Adam Gettle, who I think is an equal genius to any of the greats. But it's a frustrating time for someone who loves it, and so I've gone and put together the old ones for myself. But thank God for the Kennedy Center doing a Sondheim Festival, and hopefully they'll do a Rodgers and Hammerstein Festival and an Irving Berlin Festival
and
the Yip Harbert Festival. And then other cities will pick up this baton, and we'll have them all over the country so your kids will touch those stones.
Let's talk a bit about Mama Lotion.
Sure. I was going to say this was my favorite piece, but now the Sondheim is an equal favorite to me, so I'm a little bit at war with myself. This came about because Joe Papp came over for dinner one day. Joseph Papp, one of our greatest producers and human beings that have ever lived. He was a father figure to me. I love him very much and always will, no matter where he is. And he asked me to sing a Yiddish song for a benefit for the YIVO Foundation, the Yiddish Institute. I sang it, and he came over for a Shabbos dinner one day, and he said to me, "You have to do this music. This is your job." I promised him I would. He passed away 7 years later, or 6 years later. I still hadn't made the promise good because I didn't speak Yiddish. I only knew one or two words and one song my dad sang. And I was terrified about how to climb this mountain. So finally, after finding every excuse and doing Chicago Hope and everything else that I could find to not have to address this issue, I realized that I got to make this promise good before I leave this planet. So I called two friends who were my mentors, and they sat down with me, and I worked for over a year and a half, listened to all the repertoire that we could get a hold of, over 150 songs, culled from that what spoke to me the most. Practiced every morning at 7 o'clock with the words first. First I learned all the words till they were second nature to me. I know every word I'm singing. And then I learned the music. We put it together. And it just brings back, it connects me in the most enigmatic way to my entire heritage, to a world that I never knew. And my only advice to people after I made this project was, no matter what you are, whether you're Russian, Jewish, Polish, Italian, African American, Haitian, Islam, no matter what your culture or heritage is, find out about it. Learn the music from that culture, and it'll connect you in ways that you never imagined.
What's next for you?
I'm having a good time right now. I'm doing the Sondheim Project. We're booked all over the country starting in October. It's my happiest tour coming up yet because I'm booked in some cities doing the Sondheim show, in other cities doing the Mama Lushin concert, and in other cities doing the Potpourri concert.
Lovely to see you and to hear you.
Great to be here. Thanks a lot.
That was my 2002 interview with singer and actor Mandy Patinkin. He had just performed a tribute concert for Stephen Sondheim at the Kennedy Center. Our Twitter handle is @drshow. You can also email us at drpodcast@wamu.org or find us on Facebook. Our music is composed by Jim Brunberg and Ben Landsberg of Wonderly. The show is produced by Allison Brody. Our engineer today is Michael Kidd. Thanks for listening, all. I wish you and your loved ones a happy and healthy holiday. We'll see you in the new year. I'm Diane Rehm.